And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today's July 29th. 210th day of the year. 155 days remain till the year's over with. Do want to do a shout out before I get started to Rich Forrest, who's still sitting in the hospital in California. On this day in 587 BC, the Neo-Babylonian Empire sacks Jerusalem and destroys the first temple. 238, the Praetorian Guard storm the palace and capture Papinius and Balbinus. They're dragged through the streets of Rome and executed. On that same day, Gordian III, who was 13 years old, proclaimed the emperor. That's the sixth emperor in that year. Now, Papinus was the Roman emperor. He served with Balbinus for 3 months during the year of six emperors. Not a lot's known about him because he was executed so quickly. And Decimus, Calius, Calvinus, Balbinus was co-emperor. Both he and his sidekick were executed. Gordian III, who I said was 13, he served from 238 to 244. Became the youngest sole Roman emperor in the empire. He was the son of Antonia Gordiana and Julius Balbus, who died before 238. Now, Antonia Gordiana was the daughter of Emperor Gordian I and the younger sister of Gordian II. Very little is known about his early life before he became emperor. He assumed the name of his maternal grandfather in 238. It must be nice to be emperor at 13 years old. Your voice hadn't changed yet. 615, Pakal ascends the throne of Palenque at the age of 12. 904, the sack of Thessalonica. Saracen raiders under Leo of Tripoli sack Thessaloniki, the Byzantine Empire's second largest city. There was a short siege, and then they gained access and plundered it for a week. 923, Battle of Firenzuola. Lombard forces under King Rudolf II and Adalbert I, Margrave of Avia, defeat the dethroned Emperor Berengar I of Italy at Firenzuola, which was Tuscany. 1014, Byzantine-Bulgarian Wars, Battle of Gladion. Byzantine Emperor Basil II inflicts a decisive defeat on the Bulgarian army, and his subsequent treatment of 15,000 prisoners reportedly caused Tsar Samuel of Bulgaria to die of a heart attack less than 3 months later. He died on October the 6th. The 1018, Count Dirk III defeats an army sent by Emperor Henry II at the Battle of Villardingen. 1030, Adahari Fairhair Succession Wars, Battle of Stiklestad. King Olaf II fights and dies trying to get his Norwegian throne back, trying to get it back from the Danes. 1048, the Siege of Damascus ends in a decisive crusader defeat and leads to the disintegration of the Second Crusade. 1565, the widowed Mary, Queen of Scots, marries Henry Stuart, Lord Darnley, Duke of Albany at Holyrood Palace in Edinburgh, Scotland. 1567, infant James VI is crowned King of Scotland at Stirling. 1588, Anglo-Spanish War. The Battle of Gravelines. England's naval forces under the command of Lord Charles Howard and Sir Francis Drake defeat the Spanish Armada off the coast of Gravelines in France. Spanish Armada was, in fact, the most powerful naval force of the day. It was a Habsburg Spanish fleet of 130 ships. Sailed out of Lisbon in late 1588. In May of 1588, under the command of the Duke of Medina Sidonia, they were supposed to escort an army from Flanders to invade England. Medina Sidonia was an aristocrat without naval command experience, but King Philip II made him the commander of the fleet. They were going to overthrow Queen Elizabeth I and her establishment of Protestantism in England to stop English interference in the Spanish Netherlands and stop the harm caused by English and Dutch privateering ships and disrupted Spanish interest in the Americas. Of course, English ships sailed out from Plymouth to attack the Armada. They were smaller, faster, more maneuverable than the Spanish galleons. That enabled them to fire on the Armada without losses as the Armada sailed east off the coast, southern coast of England. The Armada could have anchored in the Solent between the Isle of Wight and the English mainland and occupied the Isle of Wight, but Medina Sidonia was under orders from King Philip II to meet up with Alexander Farnese, Duke of Parma's forces in the Netherlands, so England could be invaded by Parma's soldiers and all the other soldiers carried by in ships by the Armada. English guns damaged the Armada, and the Spanish ship was captured by the Francis Drake in the English Channel. Eventually, between the English and the weather, the Armada was thrown into great disarray. Driven by southwest winds, they withdrew to the north with the English fleet harrying it up the east coast of England. And as the Armada returned to Spain around Scotland and Ireland, it was disrupted further by storms. More than a third of the 130 ships failed to return to Spain. The plan was grandiose. The commanders had no experience. So, there's no wonder it failed. 1693, War of the Grand Alliance, the Battle of Landen. France wins a Pyrrhic victory of Allied forces in the Netherlands. It's a victory that inflicts such a devastating toll on the winner, it's tantamount to a defeat. And that's exactly what happened in this particular battle when France beat the Allied forces in the Netherlands. 1775, founding of the U.S. Army Judge Advocate General's Corps. General Washington appoints William Tudor as Judge Advocate for the Continental Army. 1818, French physicist Augustin Fresnel submits his prize-winning memoir on the diffraction of light, precisely accounting for the limited extent to which light spreads into shadows. And that demolished the oldest objections to the wave theory of light. 1836, inauguration of the Arc of Triumph in Paris. 1848, Great Famine of Ireland, temporary revolt. In County Tipperary, Ireland, and in the UK, an unsuccessful nationalist revolt against British rule was put down by the police. 1851, Annabelle de Gasparis discovers asteroid 15, Eunornia. 1858, U.S. and Japan sign the Harris Treaty. Now, the Harris Treaty was signed on the deck of the USS Powhatan in Edo, which is now Tokyo, opened the port of Kanagawa and four of the Japanese cities to trade, granted extraterritoriality to foreigners, among another group of trading stipulations. 1864, American Civil War. Confederate spy Bell Boyd arrested by Union troops and detained at the old Capitol Prison in Washington, D.C. 1871, the Connecticut Valley Railroad opens between Old Shaybrook, Connecticut and Hartford, Connecticut in the U.S. 1899, the first Hague Convention is signed. 1900, in Italy, King Umberto I of Italy is assassinated by the anarchist Gaetano Bresci. 1907, Sir Robert Baden-Powell sets up the Brown Sea Island Scout Camp in Poole Harbor on the south coast of England. Camp runs from August 1st to August 9th, regarded as the foundation of the scouting movement, which has since pretty much collapsed. 1914, the Cape Cod Canal opened. 1920, construction of the Link River Dam begins as part of the Klamath Reclamation Project. 1921, Adolf Hitler becomes leader of the National Socialist German Workers' Party. He was sent to be a observer. He was supposed to basically be a spy. And wound up taking over. 1932, Great Depression. In Washington, D.C., troops dispersed the last of the Bonus Army World War I veterans. 1937, Tangzhou Incident. In Tangzhou, China, the East Hopi Army attacks Japanese troops and civilians. 1945, the BBC Light Program radio station is launched for mainstream light entertainment and music. 1948, Olympic Games. Games of the 14th Olympiad. After a hiatus of 12 years caused by World War II, the first Summer Olympics to be held since the 1936 Summer Olympics in Berlin opens up in London. 1950, Korean War. After 4 days, the Nogunri Massacre ends with the U.S. Army 7th Cavalry Regiment being withdrawn. 4 South Korean refugees are killed in a U.S. air attack and a small and heavy weapons fire of the 7th Cav at a railroad bridge near the village of Nogunri, about 100 miles southeast of Seoul. In 2005, a South Korean government inquest certified the names of 163 dead or missing and 55 wounded. There were a number of other victims' names that were just not reported. The Nogunri Peace Foundation estimated in 2011 that between 250 and 300 people were killed, mostly women and children. The story is little known outside Korea until the Associated Press wrote a story in 1999 with 7th Cav veterans corroborated survivors' accounts. And there were declassified U.S. Army orders to fire on approaching civilians because of reports of North Korean infiltration of the refugee groups. In 2001, the U.S. Army conducted an investigation and after previously rejecting survivors' claims, it finally acknowledged the killings, but described the incident as an unfortunate tragedy inherent to war and not a deliberate killing. Bill Clinton issued a statement of regret. He was president at the time, adding the next day that things happened which were wrong. But he did nothing more, which was pretty typical of Bill Clinton. In 1957, International Atomic Energy Agency is established. Also in 57, a Tonight Show starring Jack Parr premiered on NBC. Jack Parr actually began the modern-day talk show. 1958. President Eisenhower signed into law the National Aeronautic and Space Act that created NASA. They had great hopes for it. 1959, the first U.S. Congress elections in Hawaii as the State of the Union took place on this date. 1965, Vietnam War. First 4,101st Airborne Division paratroopers arrived in Vietnam, landing at Cam Ranh Bay. 1967, Vietnam War. Off the coast of North Vietnam, the USS Forrestal catches on fire in the worst U.S. naval disaster since World War II. 134 members of the crew died. 1967, during the fourth day of celebrating its 400th anniversary, the city of Caracas, Venezuela is shaken by an earthquake. About 500 die. 1973, Greeks vote to abolish the monarchy, beginning the first period of the Metapolitsi. 1973, driver Roger Williamson is killed during the Dutch Grand Prix after suspected tire failure causes his car to pitch into the barriers at high speed. 1976, New York City. David Berkowitz, also known as the Son of Sam, kills one person and seriously wounds another in the first of a series of attacks. Supposedly, Sam was his neighbor's dog. Now, there was another story that he was a member of a organization dedicated to killing. 1980, Iran adopts a new holy flag after the Islamic Revolution. 1981, a worldwide television audience of over 700 million people watched the wedding of Charles, Prince of Wales, and Lady Diana Spencer at St. Paul's Cathedral in London. Problem is, she was a child and he was in love with Camilla Parker Bowles. In 1981, after impeachment on June 21st, Abu Hassan Benazir flies with Masoud Rajavi to Paris in an Iranian Air Force Boeing 707, piloted by Colonel Behzad Moezi, to form the National Council of Resistance of Iran. In 1987, British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher and President of France, Francois Mitterrand, signed the agreement to build a tunnel under the English Channel, also known as the Euro Tunnel or the Channel. 1987, Prime Minister of India, Rajiv Gandhi, and President of Sri Lanka, J.R. Jayawardene, signed the Indo-Sri Lanka Accord on ethnic issues. 1993, the Supreme Court of Israel acquits alleged Nazi death camp guard John Demjanjuk of all charges, and he's set free. 1996, the child protection portion of the Communications Decency Act is struck down by U.S. federal court as too broad. 2005, astronomers announced their discovery of the dwarf planet Eris. 2010, an overloaded passenger ferry capsizes on the Kasai River in Bandundu Province, Democratic Republic of Congo. At least 80 die. 2013, two passenger trains collide in the Swiss municipality of Granges-Pres-Marnand near Lausanne. 25 people are injured. 2019, the 2019 Altamira prison riot between rival Brazilian drug gangs leaves 62 people dead. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances. Christian feast day, Lazarus of Bethany, Lupus of Troyes, Martha of Bethany in the Catholic, Anglican, Lutheran Church, Mary of Bethany, Olaf II of Norway, Simplicius, Faustinus, and Beatrix. Earliest day on which Summer's Day can fall, August 4th is the latest. It's normally celebrated on Friday before the first Monday in August in Bermuda. International Tiger Day, Mohun Bagan Day in India, National Anthem Day in Romania, National Thai Language Day in Thailand, Olaf Soka or Osok, opening of the Logting Session in the Faroe Islands and other and the Nordic countries. All right, let's see what else we might have, if anything. On 362, Emperor Julianus of Constantinople ends education laws. It's okay to be a dummy. 626, Evren and the Slavs under Kagan Bahan begin the siege of Constantinople. 904, Thessalonica is sacked by Saracen pirates, led by renegade Leo of Tripoli. 1014, the Battle of Stromitsa Valley. Byzantine forces destroy the Bulgarian armies. 1030, Battle at Stiklestad. 1179, Lando Cettino proclaimed the anti-pope Innocent III. 1221, Emperor Go Horikawa, who was only 10 years old at the time, acceded to the chrysanthemum throne of Japan. 1279, five emissaries dispatched by Kublai Khan from the Mongol Yuan dynasty are beheaded by Japan, which kind of pissed off Kublai Khan. 1560, the Turkish fleet recaptures Djerba on Spanjarden. 1566, Great Britain executes Agnes Waterhouse, the first British woman convicted of witchcraft in Chelmsford, England. 1567, on this date, James VI is crowned King of the Scots at Stirling Castle. 1579, the Spanish King, Philip II, arrests plotters Antonio Perez and Princess Vanni Boldi. 1585, the University of Franeker, University of Friesland, opens in the Netherlands. 1588, Duke Farnese's troops are ready for an invasion of England. 1609, Samuel de Champlain shoots and kills two Iroquois chiefs at Ticonderoga, New York. And that set the stage for French and Indian wars for the next 150 years. 1634, the Dutch fleet under Johannes van Walbeck lands at Curaçao. 1655, the biggest town hall in the world opens in Amsterdam. 1676, Nathaniel Bacon declared a rebel for assembling frontiersmen to protect settlers from the Indians. 1696, Louis XIV, the Sun King of France, and Victor Amadeus II, Duke of Savoy, signed the Peace of Turin. It was a turning point in the War of the League of the Augsburg. 1715, 10 Spanish treasure galleons sink off the Florida coast. They're sunk by a hurricane. I've got some coins off one of them. And 1905, U.S. Secretary of War William Howard Taft makes a secret agreement with the Japanese Prime Minister Katsura, agreeing to Japanese free reign in Korea in return for non-interference with the U.S. in the Philippines, laying the basis for the Japanese actions during World War II. Alrighty. You know, we've been talking about military encounters with UFOs, and there have been a lot of them. Far more than has ever been discussed. The, in fact, I saw something earlier today that dealt with the possibility of alien bases on the moon. Now, according to the best material from science, the moon does not make sense. In fact, there's been a lot written about the moon, and there's been a lot of speculations. One of the strangest ideas is the idea that the moon might actually be hollow. And in fact, I've read a number of things that say the moon is in reality an alien spaceship, a very ancient one, and not a moon as we think of it at all. At the very least, there's a large body of folks that think that the moon is hollow. And the question arises, if the moon is just a shell, if it's hollow, what's inside? Well, you know, the idea of a hollow moon, you might initially think is laughable. But for a supposedly dead world, an airless chunk of rock that just happens to orbit our planet, there's a lot of strange things that have come to light. NASA itself commissioned a report that covers centuries and contains numerous transient lunar phenomena, or in other words, unexplained strange events. And these have occurred on the moon during that time and long before NASA was ever thought about. Now, even a quick review of some of the documentation, one including the last 500 years of observations, will tell anybody that very strange things indeed have been going on the moon. So for a dead world, it doesn't seem to be dead at all. In fact, it appears to be just the opposite, a highly active place at times, an extremely mysterious one as well. And then there are the conspiracy theories concerning NASA hiding evidence of aliens being on the moon. I've seen photographs that were sent to me by listeners of buildings that have been photographed on the moon. And then there are the conspiracy theories concerning NASA hiding all this evidence and having hidden the evidence from times past. And it's been put forth by very reliable people who either work directly for NASA, who are indirectly in positions of trust as contractors to NASA. So these aren't folks that you can dismiss as part of the fringe element or dyed-in-the-world conspiracy theorists. They've got credentials. And of course, accompanying the possibility of activity on the moon, there's a constant sighting of UFOs in our own skies. Millions around the world have claimed to have seen them. Over 1 million reports of UFO sightings come in annually on a worldwide basis. And UFOs have appeared in our heavens throughout history as well. I saw a tapestry from 700 or 800 AD. And in the sky on that tapestry, it was a scene. You see a UFO in the background. And over 1 million people have claimed to have been abducted by UFOs in recent decades alone. And a lot of folks have been hurt in UFO encounters. Some have been sickened and some have even died. So the question becomes, what does all this mean? Could the moon actually be hollow? Could it be an ancient alien spacecraft disguised as a moon? Are we being watched closely and keenly by alien intelligences? Or are they using the moon as a massive base of operations in our solar system? And in fact, I've heard many, many stories that we've been warned away from approaching the moon too closely as far as actual manned landings go. And we should note that even the most recent unmanned robotic landing that I've got records of, which is December 2013, it was done by the Chinese. It was called the Jade Rabbit. It stopped functioning almost immediately. It so far failed to come even close to completing its planned mission as a result. The Jade Rabbit, according to the Chinese, suffers from mechanical issues. They've never said what those issues are. So some very strange things exist about the moon with regard to the moon. Now there's a lot of questions, and there are equally as many explanations and theories to account for. But you have to ask yourself, is there any evidence to support these seemingly eccentric contentions? And if there are, what does that mean for us if there's any truth to them at all? What are the implications for the human race, for our future, if aliens were once on the moon or maybe even still be there? How does that affect us right now? And what are the consequences for our plans for future space exploration if any of this is true? Can we have a moon base, or are we forbidden from going there? So, if the moon is an alien base, are there other bases in our solar system? And if there are, who really rules our solar system? Who controls the skies? Is it us or them? Now, let's start out asking, why is the moon such a mysterious world? Why is it that all the moons in our solar system, the one the closest to us, the one that rules our night sky and can be seen so clearly by us, why is it the most bizarre of all the moons in the solar system? Well, let's consider what we know about it right now. The basic facts, I guess you could say. Number one, the first thing to know about the moon, the one causing the most problems for the average person, is one face of the moon is always facing the Earth. That means from Earth, we can't see the other side of the moon. Now, the other side's normally been known as the dark side. And that's a common fallacy, but it's wrong. Probably this idea of a dark side of the moon is due at least part to the musical band Pink Floyd and their album, The Dark Side of the Moon, which was a hit at one time. Well, in actuality, this term is a misnomer because there is no dark side. The side of the moon permanently wrapped in night, as it were. All sides of the moon do get sunlight, just as we do. And the moon does have a day and a night, with the daytime as well as the nighttime, each being about 14 of our days in length. One full day on the moon is about 28 days on Earth. Roughly the equivalent of 1 month. It was once known as a moont. During this time, as daylight moves slowly across the surface of the moon, we see it as phases of the moon in the night sky, more or less area of the surface of our neighbors lit by sunlight, with the moon waxing or becoming full and waning, and being reduced to new moon size. Therefore, the proper term to refer to the part of the moon we never see is the far side. And there's a reason why we stress the far side of the moon, and it's another one of those mysteries we're going to discuss as we go along. But because we only see one face of the moon, the one always facing Earth, this meant that for most of the time we've been on this planet, humans simply didn't know what the far side of the moon looked like. It was never revealed to us. So in that sense, I guess you could say it was dark. Thanks to photographs from various NASA missions to the moon, and those from satellites launched by other nations for the last decade, we think we've developed a good idea what the far side of the moon looks like. But there's a big question about those photographs. One thing scientists immediately noticed about the far side is there seemed to be a lot more craters on the side facing us. That's just another one of the mysteries of the moon. You know, the average distance to the moon from the Earth is roughly 238,900 miles. It's about 384,000 kilometers. The moon is so close to us, it's thought by many as not much more than being just a satellite of the Earth, but rather one part of what you might look at as a double planet system. In other words, to a certain degree, the moon doesn't just revolve around us. We orbit more like a spinning dumbbell around each other. And if one considers all the moons of the solar system, our moon ranks as the fifth largest. Now, the mass of the moon is about 1/80th of the Earth. By mass, we're talking about the material composes our nearest neighbor. Its density. That means gravity on the moon is only 1/6th of the Earth. Now, it's important we don't confuse the idea of mass and weight. Weight's something defined by gravity. For instance, you have a certain amount of mass, and if you step on the scales on Earth, you'll weigh a certain amount. But on the moon, you'll have exactly the same mass, but you only weigh 1/6th as much. Mass stays the same, but the weight doesn't. Now, the diameter of the moon, that is, the span of it from one edge to the other, is roughly equivalent to the width of the United States. The moon orbits the Earth at a speed of about 2,300 miles an hour. That's the equivalent of 3,700 kilometers per hour. Now, the surface of the moon has numerous craters pockmarking it. Some of these craters are quite large. And there are craters within craters, newer ones on top of older existing ones. Scientists use the new craters to determine the age of the old craters. The old ones tend to have newer ones on top of them. And in their areas called maria, from the Latin word meaning seas. Now, they're not seas, of course. Now, the moon is airless. At least that's what we're taught. Has almost no air and only traces of water. Now, these maria are large, relatively flat areas, darkly colored. And these are thought to be old lava flows. Now, the moon also has mountains, with crater walls often resembling such mountains in height. The temperatures on the moon can range from 243 degrees Fahrenheit in the daytime to minus 272 degrees Fahrenheit at night. Now, that's a heck of a range difference. And the moon's mass exerts a pull over the Earth, which is known just about everybody. The pull causes the tides, of course. And when we're talking about the possibility of the Earth, of the moon being hollow, we need to keep this in mind, because if it isn't, how do we account for the calculated mass of the Earth? Of the moon, rather. Now, let's talk about possible origins of the moon. Scientists have come up over the years with a number of theories to account for the moon even being there. The first one, which was in vogue up to the 1980s, was the theory of how the moon came to be with the Earth. The premise was very simple. Scientists said the moon was a wandering planetary body that was captured by the Earth and locked into orbit about our planet. Now, that's a very simple theory, eminently logical at first glance. And that theory has some advantages. It explains the large size of the moon. Has nothing to do with the Earth, but just wandered by and was captured. That theory also has the advantage of explaining the moon's orbit and the fact that only one face of the moon is turned toward the Earth because it's tidally locked in position that way. In other words, the Earth just grabbed the moon as a companion and kept it. Now, there are problems with this idea. For one thing, any satellite like the moon or any planet wandering so close to the Earth is more likely to collide with the Earth or cause wild orbits for both astral bodies. And one or the other, the two worlds, would get sent off on a tangent. Maybe even thrown out of the solar system for good. Now, this whole theory rests on the idea that early Earth must have had a very extensive atmosphere at one time. It had to have reached much further out into space than it does now. That would have caused friction, which would act as a brake on the moon as it passed by. It slowed it enough so it could be captured and allowed it to go into orbit about the Earth, instead of ending up on one of the other two possibilities, either a collision or being sent off into space. Another problem with this theory is we have absolutely no evidence the Earth's atmosphere ever extended that far into space. There's absolutely no supporting evidence for this idea at all. And there are other problems with this theory. One of them is the oxygen ratio of rocks found on the moon. Now, they are almost identical to the oxygen ratio of rocks on the Earth. And if the moon came from someplace else, that would seem to be very unlikely. Each planet and planetoid, even asteroids, have a unique oxygen ratio signature to their rocks, their physical makeup, if you will. And this can be very accurately measured. So the fact of the moon being captured having the exact same signature as minerals on the Earth is just very improbable. Almost all scientists now discount the idea of a captured moon and believe that it's wrong. And then there's the whole idea of the captured theory just being an incredible one. Even Isaac Asimov said the moon's too big to have been captured by the Earth. Chances of such a capture have been affected, and the moon then been taken up by a nearly circular orbit around the Earth is too small to make such an eventuality credible. So the captured theory's got some major issues, and ones which some very famous, learned, and respected people have severe doubts about being possible at all. So what was the front-runner of theories until the 1980s is nobody really buys it as credible anymore. Then there's the theory of accretion. This theory accounts for the oxygen ratio problem, saying that both worlds formed out of the early accretion disk, those rings of rubble that slowly formed planets during the early stages of the creation of our solar system. The Earth and the Moon became a double planet system, one born of the same material. But again, while that sounds eminently logical, there are problems with this theory. If the Earth and the Moon formed a double planet system to begin with, that doesn't explain the problem of the angular momentum. Now, angular momentum is not as confusing as it sounds. It simply means the degree of rotation any given body has. The Earth rotates on its axis, and that's its angular momentum. Now, the accretion theory doesn't explain why the moon has such a small iron core, comparatively speaking, to that of the Earth. If the theory is valid, the core should be more proportional, but they're not. So this theory doesn't work too well either. In fact, most scientists don't believe it's correct, even those sitting in the ivory tower. Then there's the theory of fission. It's a very old theory. It dates back, actually, to Charles Darwin. This theory states that the early Earth was spinning so quickly that due to centrifugal force, it threw off a piece of itself, which became the moon. And it was thought that that piece came from the Pacific Basin. and it literally left a hole in the early Earth with what went out to form the moon. And although that theory accounts for why the moon has the same oxygen isotope ratio as rocks on the Earth do, we now know Pacific Basin is a result of the continental drift, not because the moon blasted away from it. Then there's the problem of age. The material that makes up the moon is far older than the crust in the region of the Pacific Basin, or anywhere else for that matter. Furthermore, the theory doesn't explain away the angular momentum problem either. So, once again, we have a theory that sounded good to begin with. Then we got the theory of a geo-reactor explosion. And this is quite an interesting theory. It hypothesizes the moon is a result of a geo-reactor exploding deep in the Earth where the mantle meets the core. Now, you may think the term geo-reactor is confusing. It's really not. Nuclear reactors are possible because of radioactive elements. Put enough radioactive material too close together and you get critical mass. That means you've got enough material in close enough proximity to other similar material to cause a chain reaction resulting in an explosion. Or if controlled in the production of energy, as with nuclear reactors producing electricity. Sometimes we found doesn't really work, as we found out with Chernobyl and the Fukushima meltdowns. Sometimes these reactions get out of our control. Well, a geo-reactor is just a naturally occurring reaction, where by chance there's enough fissionable material in close enough proximity to trigger such a natural explosion. And for this to work in order to create the moon, it had to happen right at the equatorial plane of the Earth. In other words, it had to be close to the region of the equator. Moreover, it had to have been a big explosion, a very big one. Obviously, there seemed to be some problems with this theory, with such a coincidence being just one of them. But it does explain some things as well. Explains why the moon is made up of the same material as the mantle layer of the Earth, for instance. But there are problems with this theory. For instance, there's the problem with angular momentum, the orbit of the moon. They aren't the predicted results for such an event. Now, this theory is relatively new. It was only proposed in 2010, and with any new theory, it's like buying a new pair of shoes. You have to wear it until it fits just right. Then we have the theory of a giant impact. According to many scientists, the most reliable theory of the moon's origin is of a planet or a protoplanet, which they refer to as Theia, which has to have been about the size of Mars, struck the Earth early on, about 4.36 billion years ago. That was during the still formative period of the solar system and of the Earth. The impact was catastrophic, almost resulting in destroying the Earth in the process, and threw material out into a ring around our planet. Well, this ring material quickly and supposedly coalesced into the moon. So this is known as the giant impact theory. Now, it's only a theory. Best scientists come up with for now because it explains some things about the moon. But, just as with the other theories, not all the things can be explained. In any case, our moon formed out of this ring of material, coalesced into a molten ball, and what many scientists say had to be just 100 years or so in time. That's very quick. Now, there are a number of problems with the giant impact theory, and these are actually large problems. Now, if this happened, surely there would have been some material from the original Theia composing the moon as well as material from the Earth. But that doesn't seem to be any material from Theia at all. If this scenario is valid, if two worlds did collide, smashed apart, and reformed, this just doesn't seem to be a likely result. The moon should have, in fact must have, material from the other world to be found in its makeup in order for this theory to be true. So, I guess at the end of the day, you ask yourself, why is all this important? Well, there's some problems in all these theories, major ones, and they affect our coming discussion of what the moon is or really may be. Now, we'll look in closer detail at just what the problems are with the current theory and why it may not be valid at all. Now, our current most popular theory, which is the giant impact theory, supposedly takes care of all the issues about how the moon formed. It's the current and most widely popular theory. Where supposedly a Mars-sized planet impacted the Earth. This produced rings of debris that clumped together into a molten ball that became the moon. Now that sounds reasonable. But as with all things about the moon, if this is in fact how it was formed, there should be certain outcomes as a result. Now the moon's makeup and material should include some of the impacting planet's material as well as material from Earth. But rocks brought back from the moon show just doesn't seem to be the case. Hundreds of pounds of rocks from various locations are brought back by Apollo missions, and the oxygen isotopic ratio of those rocks is identical to that of Earth. Now, the likelihood that the impacting planet, which they've been calling Theia, had exactly the same isotopic ratio as Earth is exceedingly small. So if the moon is made up of debris from this other impacting planet in the Earth, it should have material from both worlds there, with distinctly different oxygen isotopic ratios. But it doesn't. And even harder to understand is the moon's titanium ratio, which turns out to be almost the same as Earth's, 4 parts per million. And this too seems to show the moon is not made up of any of this other planet's material at all. So you have to ask yourself, how can this be? When two such planetary bodies collide, trillions of tons of material should have been ejected into space as either molten and or vaporized material from both worlds. And they should have intermingled. In short, the space around the Earth should be a mass of debris from both worlds, impossible to separate out. But the moon seems to possess only material from Earth. So if the theory is correct, why would that be? Then there's the question of the volatile elements still left on the moon. Now, volatile elements simply mean substances that are very likely to vaporize under high temperature conditions and boil into space, such as water. Now, the material making up the moon is low in such volatile ingredients. And if the moon was a ball of molten magma, that would be expected. In fact, it'd be surprising if this wasn't the actual case under such formative conditions. However, the volatile elements on the moon are still higher than what one would expect from it being a ball of molten magma in the early stages of its formation. The amount of water and rocks on the moon is too high, and it should have far more boiled away in the early stages of the moon's development. And the crust of the lunar surface on the far side is thicker than the crust on the side closest to the Earth. Now, scientists attempted to explain this by saying there was a secondary and later impact on the moon by another moonlet left over in the same orbit. Now, adding this factor begins to make the theory a rather complex one, somewhat unwieldy, and all the shakier every time you have to fix it with some other possible factor. It's almost as if, as the theory begins to fail, scientists keep adding bits and pieces to it in order to try to shore it up. What they often end up with, metaphorically speaking, is an unwieldy house of cards that threatens to collapse on them at any moment. In this particular case, it's a planet colliding, the moon coalescing from the debris without any of the colliding planet's remnants in it at all, and another moonlet striking a new moon on the far side. Yeah, it's beginning to get a little hard to logically accept. So as far as we can see, although all these theories have their advantages, they all have distinct disadvantages. Even the current one and most popular one. They've got problems. Some of them big problems. And although scientists are willing to go to great lengths to prop up their favorite theories, even then there are problems with them. So what does this get us? Well, scientists the world over keep coming up with new theories as a result, attempting to better explain the origin of the moon, as with the georeactor theory that, again, was only formulated in 2010. But no one theory seems to meet the bill. And that's the reason they come and go in favor with scientists over the decades, rather than like going in and out of fashion. But they do show our moon is very odd compared to most others in the solar system, and even elsewhere in other solar systems, because we simply can't readily account for its creation. So no matter how it formed, whatever theory may be correct, if any of them are, it certainly is a strange way for our moon to have originated. And there are a number of other oddities as well. Now, besides the distinctly odd origins of the moon, whatever they may actually have been, there are other strange things about the moon, some of them truly bizarre. For one thing, the latest data of the moon rocks will seem to indicate the moon is younger than we thought. Dating samples, more accurate dating samples, show the moon is about 4.36 billion years old. Now, this is much younger than the original estimates of 4.44 to 4.567 billion years in age. So, what does this change mean? Why did the moon form much later on where there was no sea of molten magma involved in its formation? The lunar rocks are so depleted of hydrates, this shows they underwent a great heat and so must have melted to liquid magma. Estimates are that during the collision of the two planets, Theia and the Earth, temperatures would have been as high as 18,000 degrees in some areas of the explosion, and that would vaporize any volatile constituents of the rocks. And certainly the surface of the moon should have been all magma, hot liquid rock at one time as a consequence of such a catastrophic collision. But the theory requires Theia to have impacted Earth much, much earlier than the age of the moon. Now, the mare on the moon, those large dark seas of lunar material, supposed to be from magma or molten rock. But there doesn't seem to be any volcanoes on the moon. Should be at least long extinct ones if the moon never had a molten core. So how could there have been these vast fields of lava or magma coming up from the molten interior, but not a single volcano anywhere on the planet as a side effect of this vast geological activity? And to date, no volcanoes have been discovered on the moon. Well, this is a major oddity. And how do we account for the moon's relatively young age compared to that of the Earth? Right now, scientists simply can't account for it. Now, there's a plethora of theories, but none of them really seems to make any sense. So something is definitely wrong with the theory if that's the case. Now, there's another oddity that's not really a small one either. There's the oddity of the orbit of the moon around the Earth. It is almost perfectly circular. Well, if you look at other planets and their moons, almost all orbits of planets are elliptical, being sort of a slightly squashed circle in shape. Even planets found orbiting other star systems, and we found a couple of thousand of those already, have elliptical orbits. So in other words, the moon is not only in a strange orbit by our solar system standards, but it's even strange for any other solar system as well. So why would this be? Now again, there are a lot of theories, but none seem to adequately explain it. There are flaws, and I mean big flaws, inherent in all the theories. Now because of the nature of the orbit, the moon's center of gravity does not align with its geometric center. It's off by about 6,000 feet, which is a little bit over a mile. So, what does this particular oddity mean? Well, by all rights, the moon should have a pronounced wobble as a result of this fact. But it does not. And this causes a slight bulge. And where's the bulge? Yeah, well, it's on the far side of the moon. Peculiarly and coincidentally, the moon's diameter combined with its distance from Earth allows our sister world to perfectly blot out the sun during a solar eclipse. And that's just another one of the many oddities, it seems, because no other planet in our solar system has a moon that will do this anywhere nearly so perfectly. Even Isaac Asimov made a comment about it. He said, "There's no astronomical reason why the moon and the sun should fit so well. It's the sheerest of coincidences, and only the Earth among all the planets is blessed in this fashion." And that's an odd choice of words for Asimov to have used. It implies this is just short of being a miracle. And on the one planet in the system with intelligent life to can use such a blessing to such great advantage to learn things about our universe around us. Now there's another oddity. In order to have such a nearly perfect orbit, the moon had to have a very particular velocity and approach angle to start with as it came close to the Earth. And the chances of that happening are, again, very small, almost vanishingly so. That's just one more oddity. For it seems no matter how strange, how small a chance of all these things occurring, they somehow did come about. They all just happened. What was it James Bond said? Once is happenstance, twice is coincidence, three times is enemy action. Coincidences seem to be compounding themselves here. And there's something else very weird about the moon. It was first recognized with the lunar landers, and once having done their job and allowed to crash back onto the surface of the moon, the result of these crashes was a phenomenon known as resonance. In much simpler terms, the moon rang like the proverbial bell when the lander crashed. And remember, bells are by nature hollow. Now, some resonance is to be expected. Even with solid rock, if it's struck, it tends to vibrate. But this resonance, or ringing, went on for a very long time. On November 20th, 1969, for the first time, the moon rang for over an hour. Subsequently, when a portion of Apollo 13 rocket, the third stage, struck the lunar surface, the moon rang again for over 3 hours. It was just like a ringing bell. Vibration went as deep as 25 miles. Lunar seismographs left on the moon to record seismographic events, such as moonquakes, recorded all this. This vibrating implies there could well be no lunar core at all. Now, according to scientists, the moon has no magnetic field surrounding it, unlike the Earth. Our magnetic field is powerful and helps protect our planet from the solar winds, all those charged particles that otherwise strike the Earth and cause damage to our biosphere and ultimately blow away our atmosphere. This lack of magnetic field surrounding the moon also makes many scientists think the moon has no core. Or if it does, it's solid, not molten like the Earth is. What's more, if the moon is like Mars, and many people think it is, then neither world has a molten core, since Mars also lacks a magnetosphere. Current theory is that such a molten core is required to create magnetic fields around a planet. Furthermore, scientists think this is the reason Mars has long since lost much of its atmosphere due to the unobstructed pressure of the solar wind, literally blowing it away over time, because there's no magnetosphere to protect it as it is here on Earth. Now, some scientists have found an interaction between the solar wind and certain areas on the moon. They describe these areas as possibly being many magnetospheres on the surface of the moon because of this effect that they've seen. One research study said there seems to be evidence for the existence of one such magnetosphere in the Rainier Gamma area of the moon. Now, what would cause such many magnetospheres is completely unknown. Scientists can't account for it. One suggestion is they're the result of large meteor impacts, which somehow created magnetic anomalies on the moon. But the magnetospheres don't seem to be at these crater sites, but on the opposite side of the moon from them. It's hard to imagine such an effect being felt 2,000 miles away from a meteor impact and on the opposite side of the moon from these impacts. The magnetospheres are a result of these strikes. They should be much more localized to the regions where the impacts occurred. So what could account for these many magnetospheres? Scientists have no idea. An oddity about the rocks brought back from the moon is that they're magnetized. So you might ask why this is an oddity. Well, as mentioned before, the moon has no magnetic field. So without one, the rocks shouldn't be magnetized at all. Maybe some, those found locally in the area, these many magnetospheres might be magnetized, but certainly not all of them. Scientists simply can't account for the lunar material being magnetized. Then we have the helium-3 oddity. Now, we're going to talk more about this in our next show, but for right now, we run out of time. So until tomorrow at this same time, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.